Good day, all, and welcome to our launch of DS&I Deconstructs. We want to thank you for joining us as we bring together our distinguished guests to discuss topics related to the efficacy of land trusts and community organizing, and the application of racial equity at its center. Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, DS&I, formed in 1984, and is a community-based planning and organizing group in the Dudley area of Roxbury, Boston, that manages the largest urban community land trust in the country. This includes homes, community gardens and parks, and playgrounds. DS&I is a member organization with a 35-member board made up of community residents, area businesses, nonprofits, and religious institutions who help to guide the work of DS&I, which focuses primarily on community economic development, leadership development, and collaboration, and the development of the land trust. In this podcast series, we will engage our guests and listeners to question, analyze, and think towards the futurity of our community and city together. Hello, this is Dee Farai Williams of Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, DS&I. We want to welcome you to our fourth episode of DS&I Deconstructs. Hey, John. Hey. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm excited about our conversation today and the people I see around the table. Looking really forward to it.
They look great. They look a little nervous. I don't know.
Especially one of them.
Let's get some smiles going in here. So how are you feeling about what we've been doing, this endeavor to capture these really important ideas?
I feel like these conversations have been meaningful. We've been able to delve into a lot of what it means to create wealth in community, what it means to, around organizing, what it means to really build out land trust. And I think today will help really further that conversation with this group we have around the table.
And before we get started with our questions, I really want to make sure I introduce everyone. We're so happy that they're all joined us in this conversation. Today, we have Cole Huang, who is the community organizer for the Boston Neighborhood CLT. Hi, Cole.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Next, I'd like to introduce Lydia Lowe, who is the Chinatown CLT Executive Director.
Very glad to be here.
Welcome, Lydia. It's really good to see your face. It's been a little while. I'd also like to introduce Joy Gary, who is the Boston Farms CLT Executive Director.
Hi, Farai. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. And we'd also like to welcome our very own Minnie McMahon, community organizer with DS&I. Hi, Minnie.
Hi, Farai. Happy to be here.
So happy to have you here. So as we get into this conversation, I just want to frame a little bit, what is the Greater Boston Community Land Trust Network? So as we think of it, I want you to hold this. As gentrification and displacement pressures continue to grow in the Boston region, lower income neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color are looking to advance more systemic solutions. One strategy capturing increasing interest is the Community Land Trust Model, or a CLT. This form of collective land ownership through a democratically governed community nonprofit takes land off the speculative market and supports community beneficial development. CLTs protect land from the pressures of the real estate market, as the land is never resold. It remains as part of the commons. The seeds of the Greater Boston Community Land Trust, or GBCLTN, were sown several years ago when DS&I began to provide technical assistance and support to other organizations in the region interested in learning about and developing CLTs. CLTs are meant to achieve a range of interlocking goals around community stability, economic and social well-being, and increased community control and ownership of the place members call home. So let's jump right in. How do you all understand the concept of community wealth?
I think it's important when we talk about community wealth that we're not just talking about dollars. We're talking about a community's ability to thrive. We're talking about the conditions in which people live their lives. So community land trusts, I think if you look at the Dudley Triangle as an example, there are residents there who are stable, who are able to do things with their lives that they might not be able to do if they didn't live on community-owned land. Those are some of the things that we're striving to do in Chinatown, to replicate that concept, because we want that stability. We want that level of comfort and opportunity for people in our community.
I love the way you just put that, Lydia. And I do think about physical space and people and relationships and like feelings, a sense of well-being, that individuals have a sense of well-being, that there's a sense of a shared sense of well-being. So physically, I think of neighborhoods that are clean, in which people feel safe, in which there's open space and a certain amount of just like material, I don't know, things in material order that feels amenable to just going about your day freely. And then I also think of that sense of well-being also really depending on your neighbor having a sense of well-being and the people in your network and who you interact with having a sense of well-being. And it's, I think there's almost, when thinking about a definition of community wealth, it's almost in contrast to individual wealth. Like individual wealth, I think of money, right? I think of well-being as maybe different things for an individual, but community wealth, money is absolutely part of it, but it is that more sort of like holistic, it's more holistic, I think, community wealth than individual wealth.
Yeah.
Great.
I feel like I would agree. I also think of community wealth as having a sense of freedom, that collectively that you can freely make choices over yourself, over your agency, and over the resources that you have and how you can share them amongst one another. And so I think in a community that is thriving, you can freely share because you have the ability to share. And when a community is either oppressed or not thriving, you don't actually have as many choices and you cannot move as much. I think it even goes into the physical body and in the mind that you don't have a freedom of thought. And there's a level of fear when you're not being able to thrive in all areas of your life. So I think it's kind of having a collective freedom.
Thank you, Joy. Really appreciate that. This idea that it's and all of you have spoken to it, it's beyond the land. Cole, any ideas you might have?
So yeah, I was just reminded about how resources, we often think of them as financial, but it's so much more than that. So just echoing what everyone has said, the land itself as a resource, our community land trust organizations are all situated on colonized Massachusetts land. And, we're living today with like very ingrained capitalist mindsets, especially regarding to the land. So this came to mind for me, the idea of the land itself as wealth and all of the history that comes with that.
Wow. And thank you for acknowledging where our feet are right now, this idea that there are people that have been removed from this land, whose land this was. Really, thank you for bringing that up.
I just wanted to add one other thing, because I think particularly in this moment, I agree with everything we've been talking about, that's the non financial aspect of wealth, but we are also talking about economic wealth. And one of the important questions in this moment, I think, you know, is as we look at the impact of the pandemic on our communities, what will be the future of some of our smaller businesses? That is a really important question in Chinatown because, of course, Chinatown is very much characterized as a strong, small, thriving small business community. But in this moment, a lot of those businesses hang kind of on the edge. So I think that, you know, to me, when we talk about community wealth, we're also talking about that kind of support and stability for our own community businesses. Because it's very different when you have your own community corner store, your bodegas and small butcher shops in the community as compared to the big box stores and the big franchises. There's a certain kind of independence. There's a certain kind of sufficiency in the community that is really part of that holistic vision that we have.
Thank you. Thank you, Lydia. So I want to stay with this for a little bit. Might any of you have an example or an anecdote or story about the experiences of community wealth? Each and every one of you have spoken so passionately about the idea of community wealth. I'm sure you have one kind of story that might have stuck with you.
Well, actually, the story that stuck with me the most is not a story from Chinatown. It's actually Tony's story from Dudley Neighbors, Inc., because he always has talked about how the fact that he lived in a community land trust home all these years, that that's what enabled him to go on and get a graduate degree, that it just opened up opportunities for him that he might not have had. And I'm thinking about, I mean, our land trust is still so young, we don't have a lot of stories yet. But our first home buyer, I actually didn't know this until recently when we set up an interview for her with a reporter. And I found out that not only was this her first opportunity to buy a home, but that the place where she was living before, she was sharing it with two other families, one unit with two other families and her mother-in-law. So, you know, you think about the difference in your quality of life when you have a family, two young children, trying to, you know, get them to school. You're living with your mother-in-law. There may be some tension in that. And you've got two other households, one household per room in an apartment. It's a very different kind of stability and opportunity.
Yeah, I'm thinking too about we have the community land trust model and then other formal or informal, but still sort of structures or like formulations that we can look at. And thinking of worker co-ops, like worker-owned co-ops where people are working for themselves, making decisions about the company together, profit sharing, having some actual financial ownership and in their work. And also that sense, there's the sense of ownership and then there's like financial ownership. Those are both important and you don't have to have the financial ownership to have the sense of ownership. And maybe we could talk about that more too. I'm thinking of lots of cultures have like collective savings or lending practices within families or within communities. And even, you know, early pandemic days, just in my own life, I remember, people I'm in community with, but maybe a little bit removed from getting on a text chain altogether because of our physical proximity. And like, hey, is there anything do you need groceries? Do you need this? Do you need that? Do people need a ride? Who can, you know, a lot of that, like that term mutual aid has come up a lot in the last couple of years and the more in the mainstream. And those are, that's community wealth. I don't have this thing, but maybe you do, and I can turn to you for it. And so that's my answer to your question for us.
Thank you, Minnie. Thank you for bringing that in and framing that. I know, you made me think about a cultural practice that we have from Trinidad, which I know that John can speak to, and they're called susus. So this idea of mutual aid and building together. John?
Except that there's this way that we measure wealth in this country on a very individual basis, mm-hmm. right? So we scale, we can do things really as individuals, and we can tell who's the wealthiest person, who has not, and all that. Are there examples of, like, community wealth? Are there examples of measures of, like, that we can talk about community wealth? Are there historical precedents where we can look at in our culture, in our country, in our context around community wealth that has worked, right, that we can think about?
One of the things I've been thinking about a lot is the fact that the old timers in Chinatown are very nostalgic about the period before urban renewal and the community that they had before it was destroyed by the urban renewal and the highways. And what was it about that community that they're so nostalgic about? They always talk about, so this is like the from Chinatown through the New York streets where Mel King grew up, mm-hmm. that whole area. And they always talk about how everybody's was, you know, looking, everybody got along, everybody was looking out for each other's kids. They would sit on the stoop. You know, you didn't have to worry. And those kinds of things, when I think about it, that's a kind of community wealth, mm-hmm. because all of that is, it's unpaid labor. It's not a financial transaction. But those are the kinds of relationships, and that's the kind of unpaid work that a community does for its members, for each other, that really enables people to have quality of life. And we lost that when the homes were raised because of the way that it destroyed the community. In some ways, we're thinking about how do we bring that back, the concept of community governance and stewardship. How, through that concept, does it go beyond just saying, okay, you get to decide with this building that you live in, you know, how we're going to do the budget. But it's also about growing that level of community, really community building, that people know each other again, that people, again, care enough about each other that they're going to look out for each other's kids. I think that's a kind of community wealth that that we've lost.
And I feel like that also just harkens back to tribal cultures having, you know, living together, understanding each other's needs on a very intimate level. And you brought up childcare, and that I think that's something I've been thinking about a lot is a lot of my friends are having children, and the fact that there isn't really the community structure that there used to be where you're having your family living around you and your family and your friends in multiple generations raising the children that are around you. And so I think there, for many people that I've talked to, there is an element of nostalgia of having that back. And there's the rising question, can we continue to go forward and have an individualistic culture and also have the values that we're really trying to go towards? And I think the struggle, at least that I've seen within myself, is the individualistic culture has a lot to do with wanting to be able to have needs met. And those, a lot of the needs are met in having a community that you're strategic about building back together. I've even noticed kind of like the language in my community is around maturity is when you leave home and leave your family and go away and basically break apart the unity that you have. So how do we reframe our mindset around that and think of maturity of how we build a community and how can we live together? Because I think a lot of what's lost is a segmentation and a siloing of various elements of our society, whether it's age or race or industry. We're seeing a lot of the brokenness because we keep separating everything out.
I really appreciate that you named this very big component, which is culture, right? The culture of individualism, the culture of community. How would you balance the goals of individuals and community wealth? And are these goals in conflict or complementary, right? I'm hearing several of you, thank you, Joy, thank you, Lydia, talking about the what feels like a tension between those two things. Any ideas about how to balance the goals of what feels like individual wealth versus community wealth?
I think I would give an example of like what's happening at Boston Farms Community Land Trust. So we have a farmer, Sabrina Pillett Jones, who is probably in her third or fourth year farming, but she has been running her own operation for a couple of years, and she's really embedded in the community. She could sell her flowers. She grows flowers and herbs and like value-added products. She could sell it for top dollar, but she intentionally is making it available for members of her community to reduce the barrier of being able to get locally grown medicine and to learn about that medicine. And so she has classes and has times where she opens up her space for volunteers to be able to help help out. And so I think that's an example of community wealth. It's not just going for, it's not extractive of the community. It is making sure that what I'm bringing to the table is actually valuable and meeting a need. And there may be an element of sacrifice in that. And I think that generally as a culture, we do not do well with sacrificing. And I think she's kind of a hallmark example, at least in our community, that is who's building that, building kind of a community wealth model, whether knowingly or unknowingly.
That's awesome. I love Sabrina.
Yeah.
I love her. I'm just like, she's so amazing. And she's with her little one, who I'm sure is no longer a little one, but thank you. Thank you for that example.
We could talk about this forever. I'm thinking, hearing you talk, Joy, I'm thinking too of like, whatever discipline you want to talk about, it's like, I'm thinking about like healing, right? Like my healing, whatever that means for me, depends on others. And like the healing of others depends on me, right? For people in my network, and just how in that, like we need, like individual wealth can support community wealth and community wealth supports individual wealth on that sort of more, you know, more intangible side. But then I'm also thinking within the community land trust model, we have equity formulas, right, about when you're talking about home ownership that are decided upon at a certain place and time, give whatever the community contexts are, whatever the going rate is, what, you know, we have to think about the consumer price index and not having the home be above, like at or above market rate. And we also have to look at what's actually affordable to people in this neighborhood. So there is some classic Western economics that have to go into, yeah, what is individual wealth? What does money wealth mean in this? What is meaningful financial wealth in this context? And how much of that can you go for without sacrificing the other aspects of wealth, of community wealth? And I think it probably depends on the community land trust, how those calculations are made. And I think of, you know, learning the history of DS&I, a lot of it is, some of it is reading and movies, and mostly it's oral history that I've been exposed to. And one thing that sticks with me is that at that time that DS&I was formed and the land was taken by the people for the people's benefit, What was emphasized was like, oh, we get to rebuild. We get to rebuild this place so that we can be here and so that it felt the way it felt a generation or two generations ago. And that was about stability and home, right? And probably about, I mean, probably about individual financial gain as well. But that story, that motivation does not rise up in the same way that the community wealth story does. So yeah, I think, and I also think it's just generally speaking on the community wealth conversation, we were talking about this before we came in to record, is like, we're so steeped in this culture that understands individual wealth. And that, like, this whole concept of community wealth, even though I think there's something innate in everybody to understand that, and even though we all at this table are working in that field every day, it's still hard to, it's hard to capture. And it's hard, I think it's, it is hard to measure and track. How do we, what's the right, there's no singular right measure of it.
I mean, I think that when somebody comes to buy a community land trust home, we're making home ownership possible to people who probably wouldn't be able to have a home otherwise. And at that point, and as people live in the home, people are thrilled and really embrace that idea that they are going to build their own individual and family wealth through this stable home that will appreciate, you know, in a modest way, and that they'll be building community wealth in the sense that when, if they leave, if they sell, it will still be affordable to the community. So I think there's a lot of support for that at that moment. I think what's really difficult is if you are a homeowner whose home was never, you didn't receive that as an affordable home. You bought it on the market. You've seen all of the real estate values around you go up. You have been conditioned to believe that that real estate value, speculative as it may be, is mine, and that belongs to me and my family. And so the idea of somebody selling their home for something a little less in order to make it stable for the community, that's a really hard sell.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, capitalist society, it conditions us that, you know, it's the survival of the fittest. You've got to fight for everything, you know, everything that you can get, you know, everything that you can get, you have a right to. And it's all framed in that very individualistic mindset. So it's just an automatic reaction, I think, knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, it affects the shape in every way, you know, every sense of that, how people think, how people feel, how people show up. Being in a capitalistic context does certainly strain and create even more tension between that sense of community and the individual building of wealth.
Yeah, given the definitions that you all have talked about in terms of community wealth and community well-being and really wonderful way that you've defined it, I'm just thinking about, but also given what Lydia just said about the tensions that exist between individual and community, how do we take this model that we all work in every day, that you so eloquently said many, how do we really take this model about community land trusts, keep right-sized organizations, and really scale up? How do we continue to do that? Because we are definitely in a moment where this conversation has gained traction. So the idea of wealth building and building deeper communities and connections, especially because I think through the pandemic, right? So how do we, what are some thoughts about how we build these organizations, scale up these models? I'm going to throw it out to Cole first.
Sure. Yeah, I love this question about scaling up because the Boston Neighborhood Community Land Trust has been a community land trust for just the past couple years. So it's something that is very on our minds. As the organizer, for example, I have been really involved in activating a couple of vacant lots that are right near one of our properties. And this goes back to our conversation about community wealth. The residents of our building on that street, as well as the neighbors of the vacant lots and other adjacent neighbors, have now been organized around constructing a garden bed and a little free library and just like really activating that space. And so it's really like when I think about scaling up, I just have this image in my mind of this segment of the street where there's been community wealth built and there's so much potential for more. And if we could scale up, you know, right now our organization has 2 full-time staff. Imagine like how this could grow in the future, and how if we invest in community land trusts, even beyond just the ways we can measure, and we often do in grant applications, measure financial prosperity and certain categories. There's other ways we can't measure. You can't measure the safety, like sense of safety. Maybe, I don't know. It's hard to think of measuring all the aspects of community wealth, even the spiritual aspects. So yeah, we have to scale up this model. And I think that community land trusts really do balance this individual and community wealth in a powerful way. And yeah, I would like to pass on to anyone who has more thoughts about how scaling up would look.
I mean, I think because what we're trying to do is so difficult to take control of the land in our society, we can't really scale up without the role of the public sector and government. But in order to get there, what's really critical is that we are building models and we're able to lift those models up and really make visible what we're doing, even if it is on a small scale, because a small scale can have a big impact, especially if you're in a small community like Chinatown. The fact that we were able to take 2 row houses that were used for short-term rental and bring them back to the community, it's a big story in Chinatown. So I think that we need to understand the power of the story. And by lifting up the examples of the amazing things that people, the groups in our network are doing, that can inspire people and see the possibilities that are out there. And I think it's at that point, and, you know, and that is connected to the organizing that we need to do to really influence our local government and, you know, eventually the state, et cetera. But it's, we're not going to be able to reach that kind of scale unless we affect consciousness and we affect government.
Whose consciousness, you think?
Well, I think it's the community's own consciousness, you know, for us to be able to build that kind of power, that we really start to move different policies, move public land, move public resources in a way that we need.
I think there's value in community land trusts outside of housing. And so we need both those who are housing stable and unstable to be on board with the model. And so I see it expanding when we do more mixed use of properties. So housing and economic opportunities through enterprises and having commercial space, mixing those with also farming or agricultural opportunities. I think there's a number of examples of that across the country where that has been successful. But it allows us to be able to meet the community's needs. So one of the things we were talking about earlier of just being able to live in your community and have your needs met there. There's a lot of communities that you can't get basic food needs met, clothing needs. So having a really good assessment of a community's lifestyle needs and how they're being met, and then how can we get a strategy to meet them in the community, and then utilizing where there's open spaces to create mixed development, I think that's a really good possibility and strategy for us to be able to expand this model and then think about how can we partner throughout the region to be able to do that? That may be a little bit too ambitious, but I think it can't. That's something that can happen, and if it's successful in one place, I think it can catch on in a very like rapid fire.
I don't think that's too ambitious.
Do you think it's idealistic?
The question: what is a meaningful scale? That word, right? Because it means a lot to the people who are currently impacted and like know that and are like choosing that and really involved, engaged with that. And then, but yeah, it's like, what is meaningful scale for totally shifting the way that wealth and power work in this country, maybe there's no meaningful scale, because if we were to get that big as CLTs, then we'd, you know, we'd be another sort of dominant system, or like, this is the right way to do things. So I think this question is very much what we're faced with right now. Like, how do we not be very niche? How do we affect cultural change as well as like neighborhood scale change? But I do think, in terms of like being ambitious, what excited me so much about community land trust as a student, and that's how I got into this work, was studying about this, is it is a political, it is a philosophical, it's a different system. It's still a system that depends on private control of land. They're nonprofits, they're community led. It's not perfect, but it's an alternative to domination of land. It's an alternative to capitalism. And I think for many people, that's actually very compelling when you start to experience it.
That's great that you went right there, Benny. And I know that we didn't coordinate this, but I'd like to pivot a little bit in the conversation and talk about how should we be thinking about CLTs within the wider affordable housing and space, right? The progressive left movement space, CDCs. What do you think about that? Because it is, a CLT is one strategy.
Right. And I don't think that while we're trying to grow the community land trust model, I don't think we're saying the CLTs are the answer and the only answer. I believe in organizing for reinvestment in public housing. I think that some of our community development corporations are actually better positioned in this moment to build affordable housing on a bigger scale than many of our community land trusts are. But I think we need all of those approaches. And but at the heart of all of these approaches is building power, because unless we can build power in our communities, the communities that have been most disenfranchised and have suffered the most, we're not going to be able to create the change that we need at the scale that we need. And I see community land trusts playing a particular role in that power building, because we may not always be the ones that are out there with the bullhorn first. I don't think that's the strength. That's the main strength of the community land trust as compared to some of the other grassroots organizing groups. But I think that we are embedded in the power building model, and that we see the role that we're playing in promoting a positive kind of governance and a positive kind of stewardship as a part of that power building.
What traps can CLTs fall into?
How much time do we have?
One thing that just jumps into my mind is, I think it was a Shelter Force article a couple years ago that says, where is the community in CLTs? And so I think, again, if you see a model that looks like a really good idea, or that worked in that place, and let's do that here, let's recreate it, let's follow the sort of the, like, let's look at the concrete materials to put that thing into place, and maybe all the other inconcrete things aren't part of it. The governance part, is it coming from a need and a desire and movement at the grassroots level? So I think, not that it, I don't know, I think it's probably helpful when sometimes it's a bottom-down initiative. If a city wants to start a CLT and invest in it, I don't think that's a problem by definition. But I think a trap would be, oh, this is some really righteous model and we're doing it too and there's no problem here. And like in it goes to the scaling up question, if your interest is in more and more portfolio, more and more real estate, that could be troublesome that can ultimately not have great outcomes for your community. I'm speaking generally because I'm not like, this CLT is messed up. And even if I thought that, I would. But I think too of the CDC, what I understand of the CDC, the trajectory of the CDC movement from its original days, like coming much more out of neighborhood control, and many CDCs today being major affordable housing developers, and that being a top priority. There are many CDCs, they do different things. That's not true for all of them, but you see a lot of literature on that, like CDCs starting as a really community type of organization, and many having moved away from that. And we, you know, that could happen to community land trusts as well.
I like how you're thinking. I often think to myself, where is and how do we still create or maintain a space where the new to emerge as well? The CLT model is one model. CDC models was one model. How do we balance that out and still hold the space for something new to continue to emerge? So I really appreciate one that you named also, Lydia, that, you know, CLTs is one model. It's not all of them. But speaking of, what should community groups understand about the role of CLTs as landowners and stakeholders with a financial interest?
Could you explain that question a little more?
I'm going to turn to Minnie, because Minnie was within the context of our D&I land trust and then has moved into to community organizing. She also, transparency, supported the crafting of some of these questions. So what's your thinking?
I'm thinking about the Solidarity and Economy Initiative space, and are like DS&I representing the Greater Boston Community Land Trust Network in that space. And sometimes what I experience is an idea that there are the like so-called like people on the ground, frontline organizers, and then there are CLTs because like, oh, well, we're now in the land game or in the real estate game. So like, so in a sense, I'm kind of like, oh, do people like, when does a mom and pop become like the Walmart, right? Like, when are you rooting for something and then it's too big and you're the bad guy? So that's where that question came from. That's where the question comes from.
Does that make sense, Lydia?
Okay.
A little bit more?
Yeah.
I mean, we're also, to me, it harkens back to this idea of scale. Once you go to scale, oftentimes, the principles at which something was created, divined, operating, once it moves to scale, it oftentimes can lose some of its just kind of base level principles and become something else. But as CLTs do, right, they're in the nonprofit model, land ownership model. Is there a financial interest that CLTs have?
Of course there's a financial interest because you're the owner of the property and, you know, it's in your interest to make sure that that property is able to maintain. But I think the critical question here is how do you still keep the community's goals and the community's interests at the forefront?
Absolutely.
It's all about that community governance. And so if the community is really at the heart of what you're doing and the heart of your operations, then it's involving the community and thinking about those questions of, you know, what are the finances of this project? How are we going to make this viable together?
You're leaning into something, this idea of accountability, right? Accountability to those that the community land trusts are designed to serve. Can each of you talk maybe a little bit about your governance within your own CLT? Like, is a board-led governance? You know, I know some of the answers to this question, but how are those boards being managed? And how does that speak to this level of accountability? Even though, yes, there is this land ownership that is happening. Yes, there is a financial interest that is happening. How do you maintain accountability based on the shape of your particular CLT?
Yeah, I can speak to Boston Farms. So one of the things, the core root of our mission is to make sure that both the staff, the board, are from the community and are in service, living in service to the community. And so about 90% of our staff are directly from the community, which would essentially be one member of the staff that is in support of the community, but not directly living in our communities. And then our board structure is the same, that we give priority to members of the community who are interested in land governance and also in urban farming. And we hold seats that are specific for farmers that are farmers on our land and then farmers that are in the wider community. We are in the process of creating a community advisor group that is community stakeholders, whether it's abutters or people who are just interested in our programming. And those advisors would sit on the board and they would be the ones to make decisions around who's going to be a farmer when there's a land opening up. How are we going to move forward? And so we're expecting that over the next year that we'll have even more direct abutters who are really experiencing what's happening with the properties will be on the board, but we do have a number, like our general frame is to make sure that at least 80% of our board and staff are direct members of our community.
So, yeah, I can talk about Boston Neighborhood Community Land Trust. Our organization, we have a third of our board is community members and residents. We have two residents currently on our board, one of whom is the board president, and we're actively having more. We're actively recruiting more residents to meet that, and our organization has regular resident meetings, and the residents are on the stewardship committee of the organization and just involved in the operating of the organization, involved in other organizing. There's initiatives starting like a resident fund. Residents are really interested in rent to own and pathways to home ownership. So those groups are emerging, and you know, because our organization is rental properties currently. We were founded in 2008 as the Coalition of Occupied Homes in Foreclosure. So this is before we were a land trust. And several residents of foreclosed homes were able to stay on in their homes because of this activism. And then for the past couple years, we've been a community land trust. So our development of governance is very in process, and it's very much on my mind as the organizer right now. And it's something that we're actively developing. So it's very exciting.
I think resident involvement and resident control of our boards is, or in the case of Boston Farms or farmers, that's kind of the bottom line and the core of community governance. But depending on your context, there are many other ways that we need to involve the community and involve people in governance as well, because only so many people sit on a board. And we do that in a variety of ways. We'll have different kinds of committees. We'll actually spin off other entities. We created a Friends of Reggie Wong Park in order to have a nonprofit that would really govern that park, which we then partner with. We have committees that focus on public land issues, that focus on other things. I think what's really challenging for Community Land Trust is that our goal is that kind of community governance, and at the same time operating within the system as we are, there are so many details and so much work involved in just making that deal so you can acquire the land, in figuring out, you know, how do you make that housing, quality housing. It is very easy to get overwhelmed with the level of legal, financial, and technical detail that you need to learn and really manage responsibly. And so the challenge is to do that, to do a good job with that, but to always keep the community involvement and community organizing at the center.
Minnie, as our community organizer, you speak to one way in which that that flows well with, you know, what we're doing. We are a land trust, but the focus of our work is also happens through organizing. Can you make a bridge there, a connection, and then this idea of, again, accountability to community?
Yeah. So the DSNI is the parent organization, the community organizing group that has a 35-member board, which is an elected board. It's a community board, so people run and are elected based on who they are, the fact that they live in their neighborhood and their commitment to the neighborhood, not the money that they can bring or raise. And then that board elects the board of Dudley Neighbors Incorporated, the community land trust. So there's some built-in board elects board, and the purpose of the CLT is to help carry out some of the development aspects of the mission the people of DSNI. Like Chinatown CLT, we have committees. We have a sustainable development committee that reviews projects that come through our neighborhood, and that review is done based on community decided guidelines about what is beneficial in the community, not based on what the city says or what's possible, ideas of what's possible, but based on what people want to see. And one example, you know, a concrete thing is DNI acquired a 20,000 square foot commercial building in Upham's Corner with the intention, purpose to redevelop it into affordable housing and commercial space, affordable commercial space. And towards the end of the design process about what would be at that building, a steering committee of interested members was convened to make a decision, to make a recommendation to the board of DSNI and to the board of DNI about what developer should be chosen for that project. So, that is actually a great example of residents who are many professionals, but not real estate professionals, not CLT people, looking at documents, looking at development proposals, working through them, trainings to understand them, to understand what's been written and, you know, is this really viable? Is this not viable? Really supporting those decision makers in so that they could make a good decision without having a ton of technical expertise. So that's one process that marries, I think, the numbers with the community purpose and vision.
Yes. Yes. In fact, it does. Thank you, Minnie. John.
As we come to the end of the conversation, sort of begin to wrap up, thinking about framing these challenges, benefits, all of the things we've talked about through a racial justice lens, right? And if we're thinking about this, you know, how can we, so we exist in this capitalist system, we're talking about community wealth, we're talking about well-being of communities, we're talking, right? And so how can we produce this system, promote this model, without sort of reproducing this whole idea of winners and losers, and are only, and that you people have to own things to create wealth, right? And does that take away from racial justice? I mean, if we build housing, if we restore housing, if we buy housing, anybody can come live there, right? It doesn't have to just be people of color or BIPOC populations. So how are we looking at this through sort of like a racial justice lens is an interesting challenge, I think, right? I mean, anybody can come to your firm
yeah.
and grow right. anything they want to.
Yeah, anyone can come to our farms. We are prioritizing BIPOC members of our community, Black and Brown members of our community, because we want to deal with, just as you said, the racial equity issue of farmers, but also just Black and Brown people being able to build enterprises that are viable. And so we're dealing with both farming and the food enterprise space. And so we want to make sure that the communities that are predominantly Black and Brown, Dorchester, Roxbury, or Mattapan, have opportunities to be able to thrive in the green enterprise sphere. So there's lots of opportunities that we're hoping over the next few years to be able to open up to the community. But we believe that as we're seeing, more health and thriving in these communities, then we can open it up to provide opportunities for non-Black and Brown members to be able to join in. But at the moment, I feel like that's our priority.
I really feel that the struggle around racial justice, racial and economic justice, it's at the heart of what our community land trust is about, because we're fighting for the survival of our historic community of color. And I think that the reparation, you know, when we talk about reparations for the wrongs that have been done to people in the past, reparations needs to take the system of racial oppression has touched every aspect of our lives, right? And so reparations is not just a one-sided, one-aspect, one-faceted thing. So, you know, certainly we can say, well, there was redlining. That was discriminatory lending practices. So actually we should look at lending practices and make affirmative efforts to really offer loans at good, you know, low interest rates, particularly to people of color. I think those kinds of programs are so important. At the same time, we cannot think that the main way and the only way that we're going to build racial wealth equity or address the racial wealth gap is going to be through home ownership, because, which is the main thing that we hear all the time, because home ownership itself as a wealth building thing was built upon this system of racial injustice.
That's right.
And we're not trying to perpetuate the system of racial injustice. So I'm not saying that, you know, you're Black and Brown, you shouldn't go buy your own home. I am all for that. But at the same time, as we as community land trust and as a collective movement are organizing, we're also organizing for the right to our communities. And that means keeping our communities here in Boston, fighting the anti-displacement as well. Because unless we're here to have that, to be able to build that collective struggle and that collective power, then, you know, we can just hang up our hats.
I would say that each person at this table has their hat on, is girded for it, and is digging in, and I really appreciate that. We want to thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today and chat. And I really appreciate where you landed us, Lydia, because our next episode is going to focus on the racial wealth gap. Like, it's right there. And shortly thereafter, we will be talking about reparations. So I think that this is a wonderful place for us to pause the conversation, but it will be continuing. Again, thank you so much. Thank you. Cole Huang of the Boston Neighborhood CLT, Lydia Lowe of Chinatown CLT, the Executive Director, Ms. Joy Gary of the Boston Farm CLT, Executive Director, and of course, our very own Minnie McMahon, the community organizer of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. And thank you, John, for always
thank
being
you.
Such a wonderful
thank
co-host.
You.
Everyone, have a very good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.